This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Nobody who knew Kimberly Johnson as a little girl would be surprised to hear she became a doctor when she grew up. She's one of those kids who was always at the top of her class and destined for big things. In college, she decided she wanted to help underserved populations, and she planned to become a doctor and then go back to her hometown and work at a health center for uninsured and underinsured people. The area was home to one of the first independent black towns in America. But when she went to Duke for her internship, she fell in love with academic medicine. Even though she didn't move home, she is still working to help people who are underserved by the healthcare system, and now she works to close the racial gap in end-of-life care. Dr. Kimberly Johnson, welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you for inviting me.
It's a pleasure to have you, and we want to talk all about your work because it's exciting and interesting stuff. But take us back now to your hometown of Winstonville, Mississippi. What was it like growing up there?
So I lived in Winstonville, Mississippi. It's a small town in northwest Mississippi, a very rural community. And I lived between the hometowns of my mom and my dad. And so right in the middle to the north is Shelby, Mississippi. That's where my father grew up, 2 miles. 2 miles to the south, Mound Bayou, Mississippi, is where my mom grew up. And so I'm very much the product of the village. I spent a lot of time with cousins, aunts, uncles, and grandparents on both sides of my family growing up. One of the things that I often talk about, and it's really a source of pride and I think really informs my approach and has been really instrumental in my success, is the kind of community that I grew up in. So I went to school in Mound Bayou, Mississippi. And as you pointed out, Mound Bayou is actually the oldest all-black town in the United States. And so it has quite historic significance. It was founded in the late 1880s by former slaves. And at one point, it was the largest all-African-American town in the United States. I'm not sure if it's still the largest. And so when I was in high school, everyone in my class looked like me. Everyone in my school was African-American. I went to a smaller elementary school in the area, so there were two choices. One was St. Gabriel, and so it was a Catholic school. And I went to the Catholic elementary school there. And while all of the students were African-American, actually, there were a few nuns who were white. And so I think from a very, very early age, I was pressed to achieve. And I think as I've moved out of Mound Bayou and had connections with others, I find that people who were in communities where they were actually the minority often describe instances of discrimination or concerns related to race that I never had to deal with growing up in that community.
Well, that's interesting because you did go to an HBCU, and that's where you'd run into a lot of fellow students who may have had that experience, right?
Absolutely. So I went to an HBCU, historically black college, and that was Dillard University in New Orleans. And so I think it was that community was also largely African-American, and I often heard stories from classmates about their experiences and really came to appreciate how those experiences differed from my own.
Because we've heard so often, certainly I've talked to a number of people, and I'm sure you've heard it, where people, that was the first time that many people say they were surrounded by people who look like them going to an HBCU. And of course, for you, you're saying that's not at all the case, right?
That's not at all the case. And so in a very real way, I kind of moved my environment from high school to college. And, you know, to make sure that that environment stayed intact, I took my very best friend with me, who was my college roommate. And so for me, it was really a continuum.
What was your sense, though, of the racial divide, racial discrimination? Did you feel it in that community, growing up in that community? How was it portrayed and conveyed to you? What was your personal experience of it?
There wasn't much on a day-to-day basis in terms of a personal experience with discrimination. As I said, everyone looked like me in terms of the people who visited my homes and whose homes I visited. I didn't have white friends. My parents didn't have white friends or colleagues, even though the closest large town was about 20 miles away. It was Cleveland, Mississippi, and it was a mixed community. In fact, most people worked there. My mom was a nurse, so she worked at the hospital there. My dad was a factory worker. He worked there. And I think even though that wasn't a part of my day-to-day experience, there was a lot of conversation about quote-unquote white people. And so I think that I was very aware that there was something different about white race. And so, and those conversations often related to racial discrimination in lots of aspects of society, in employment, in the criminal justice system. And I think the messages early on, even though I wasn't directly exposed, also reinforced the idea that there were potential barriers outside of my community to my success. And so, like many of my colleagues, my parents always told me that you have to be twice as good as white people to achieve the same level of success. On the one hand, on the other hand, I was told you can absolutely do anything that you want to do if you work hard enough.
And you did experience some of this. I understand that you at a science fair held at Delta State University. I'm not sure how old you were at that point, but then that's when you perhaps first or at least at some point experienced this directly.
Yeah, when I think about early memories of racial discrimination, many of those related to competitions outside of my immediate community and my school. And so I remember one of my most vivid memories is of the oratorical contest. And so I participated in the oratorical contest sponsored by the American Legion. I was really excited. I loved public speaking. And as part of the oratorical contest, we would prepare a 10-minute presentation on some aspect of the U.S. Constitution. And so I gave a presentation on why I thought capital punishment was wrong. In addition to that, there would be 9 to 10 articles or amendments in the Constitution. One would be chosen at random, and you would give what was called a 3 to 5 minute extemporaneous discourse. And so you didn't know which one would be chosen. And so I remember being in this oratorical contest, again, you know, spurred on by someone from the village, people who had attended my church and were in school and thought I should really do this. And I won at the local school level, and there were some more local areas where I participated, primarily against other African Americans in small towns in that area. And there was the competition in Jackson, Mississippi, which is the state capital. And at that competition, I was the only African American participating. There were a number of whites. The judges were whites, and I had traveled there with my parents and some other members of my community. And I didn't win. And I remember one of the members of my community saying, "I was not at all surprised. I expected that you would not win, although you were clearly better than anyone else here." I remember afterwards several of the judges coming up asking me how I had prepared for this. How had I done so well on the extemporaneous choice? Did I learn something from each of those parts of the Constitution? And really, my memory is really of being in a fog. I also remember that there was someone there from the NAACP who had heard about the competition, knew I was in it, and had joined it. But I think it was definitely one of the more vivid memories of perceived racial discrimination. I had not heard the other presentations. We were not allowed to. But there was so much conversation that directly impacted me. I remember crying all the way home, which was over a 2-hour ride. It's the first time I remember crying about what I would consider to be unfair treatment.
Well, and it's a fascinating story. And the reason I wanted to spend this much time on it is to try, because we'll never know. I mean, maybe the winner, you know, whether or not discrimination played a part, we can certainly guess. But the important thing is that that was part of the story, and that's what you were hearing. At the same time, you were hearing from your family, particularly your father, that you can do anything you want.
Absolutely. I often think about that contradiction, right, that there is this racism out there. There are these discrimination and things that serve as barriers to your success. Yet, if you try hard enough, you can overcome them and achieve. And my father was a huge proponent of education. He absolutely believed that if you studied hard enough, that you could achieve anything and that your primary focus should be studying. I remember I wanted to play basketball in high school. I thought I was good. In fact, I met my husband on the basketball court. And the coach asked my father, "Oh, Kim is really good. I've seen her in PE. Can she play?" And he said, "Absolutely not." And I remember having a conversation with him about, why can't I play basketball? He talked about, he said, well, you can play in the backyard. After all, I have put a goal back there for you. But it's about travel and other things that take you away from the things that I think are most important, which is your education.
I'm wondering at this point, and again, we'll talk about, because I think there is also a way in which he played a part in your romantic life, of tempering that to make sure it didn't get in the way, right?
Absolutely.
And so how much of this do you receive as, you know, a father who's mate wanting the best for his daughter, right? Mm-hmm. But what about this other filter, this other overlay of having to work extra hard because of discrimination in this country? That's a message you're receiving as well. How big a part of that was that playing in your own mind in this moment as you're trying to imagine your future?
You know, what's really interesting about that piece is that while that message was there, because racial discrimination was part of my everyday life, it wasn't a motivation. I think I was motivated to achieve and achieve highly outside of that. I think that message only came clear as I moved outside of those circles. And so it was present, but definitely not the driving force. My husband reminds me that I have always been extremely competitive in whichever circles I'm in. In fact, we recently talked about how competitive I can be. And so that piece, I think, was really about you can and will be the best that you can be.
Well, we'll find out what happened when you moved outside those circles when my conversation continues with Dr. Kimberly Johnson, an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatrics and a senior fellow in the Center for the Study of Aging and Human Development at Duke University School of Medicine. Just ahead, we'll talk more about her time in college and beyond and what led her to her field of study right now. We'll talk about it on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow, and I'm talking with Dr. Kimberly Johnson, who grew up in a historically all-black community in Mississippi, is now a professor in Duke University School of Medicine, and studies how to close the racial gap in end-of-life care. We talked earlier about going to Dillard University in New Orleans. Why did you choose to go there?
I chose to go to Dillard University because actually several members of my church had gone to Dillard University and recommended it. So I was a member of the local United Methodist Church. Dillard University has a relationship with the local United Methodist Church. And one of the things I loved about my church congregation in looking back is that they were always creating opportunities for me to do things that I may not have thought of doing. So I ended up having the opportunity to spend a summer when I was in high school taking college courses at Dillard University, and this was spearheaded by one of the members of my church, Mr. Dennis, who was a pharmacist. I fell in love with Dillard and the campus and college life. In fact, I was going to 12th grade the summer before the summer that I spent there. My next year, I would be a senior and had the opportunity to instead skip my senior year and remain at Dillard. I didn't do that. I wanted to go back and spend my senior year in Mound Bayou.
So a really bright student, always doing well, always the top of her class until you take calculus.
Until I take calculus. So that was an interesting experience. This was the first time I was afraid of failing something. And I will say that in high school, one of the more challenging subjects for me was geometry. But there was no way my father was going to allow me to fail geometry. And so he took me to his high school geometry teacher in his hometown and paid for me to have private tutoring there. So when calculus started, what I recognized early on was there was something different about the quality of education that I had received in some respects in Mound Bayou than in other areas, particularly primarily majority communities. I had never considered this. So when we started the course, I had a full scholarship, so I did not have to take the usual math placement test. I was placed in calculus right away. No one asked me if I knew calculus. And many of the students had already taken calculus in high school. I had never had calculus. We took a pretest. And after the pretest, when we were given back our results, we were told that based on our scores on the pretest, that we would likely get an A, B, C, or D in the class, or an F. I fell in the C, D range. I was absolutely horrified. I had never seen a grade like that. In fact, I took the Scantron and hid it in my desk drawer in my class, in my dorm room. Yeah.
What's your reaction to this? You're not happy. This is the lowest grade, or at least a prediction of the lowest grade you've ever seen in your life. What did you start thinking about yourself?
Well, I started worrying, and I immediately started thinking about what my dad had told me and told my best friend when we went to college, that he had hoped that we would do well and not return with a banana and a funny book on the Greyhound bus.
What is that?
My father was a comedian, but he talked about people who went off to college from small towns and had done well, but suddenly were not doing well, and they would come back. The college would give them a comic book and a banana on their way home on the Greyhound bus. So I feared that that might be my fate. I studied extra hard. There was still the thing in my head that if you work hard enough, you can achieve anything. And in fact, I received a perfect score on every single test. And so my grade was an A, despite that.
In calculus.
In calculus.
So what did that mean? Because as you said, you didn't take it, and a lot of kids had. They'd probably taken AP classes. And I'm going to just go off on a little tangent here and then come back. You know, we often talk about the school-to-prison pipeline. I know this is outside of your area of expertise, but I think this is a moment to highlight that. When students are misplaced, and we've seen it so often, and we have the research to indicate how implicit bias is playing a role.
Absolutely.
In misplacing students early on. And so kids who should be on an AP track who are students of color aren't going there. They don't take AP, and then they get to college and they end up in that situation. And this is the horror, and this is the destruction of this kind of thing, of implicit bias, school-to-prison pipeline. So I wanted to take that tangent to highlight this moment. You've achieved, and you managed to bypass all of that and do it. How did you do that? I mean, were you studying day and night? Did you have a tutor? What'd you do to make up?
So we didn't have AP classes in my high school. That was something I knew nothing about until people talked about that in college. I studied. I went to the math. There was a math lab where you could receive additional help. So I spent time there, and I studied a lot.
And you decided to be a chemistry major?
I did. One of the courses that I really loved in high school was chemistry. My chemistry teacher was Mr. Wilder, and it was something about the systematic nature of chemistry that really appealed to me. The summer that I spent in Dillard before going there for college, I took a chemistry course because of my interest, and it really just kind of further fueled my enthusiasm for chemistry, and I decided, well, I'll be a chemistry major.
Were you thinking about medicine as any part of that, or...?
Not at the time, although my father did think that I should become a doctor. I was not thinking of medicine at the time, and I thought that I would work in a chemistry lab. I had spent some time in the lab during high school. I had the chance to go to Delta State University and work on a science project. Someone in my high school created that opportunity for me, and I had spent time in the lab during the summer at Dillard, and I thought, gee, I could do this, that I'll become a chemist. Now, exactly what that looked like, I wasn't really sure.
You talked about, and we've heard certainly the importance of your father in your life, always promoting you, making sure that you were on the right track. And you lost your father your freshman year of college.
I did. My father and I were extremely close. And I would say of all of the kind of pushers of education, there was no one who did that more than my father, even though he never finished college himself. He worked at a factory. He spent some time in junior college around the Vietnam War, I'm told. He was avoiding the draft, but he never finished. For me, that definitely was a pivotal moment. My father was killed during my freshman year. It was right after the start of the second semester, and I remember it distinctly because it was Super Bowl Sunday. The year was 1990, and Dillard's band was performing in the Super Bowl. I can remember thinking, oh, I'll call my father. I would call my father almost every night. And he also, my mom talks about this, would write me letters. And she would say, why are you writing, Kim? You know she's going to call you in a few minutes anyway. And he would write in his letters with, I can end this now because you'll be calling soon. My father was killed and robbed. He owned a business. He was an entrepreneur from, you know, way back. My mom remembers that when they first met, he was selling cucumbers, and later he had a cafe and a pool hall, and he was robbed after he closed his pool hall and shot.
Mm-hmm. What effect, what impact did that have on you? You're going to school. I can't imagine.
Yes, so I went home with my best friend, not knowing why we were going home. Initially, I was told that our counselor was sick. And I remember just trying to process this after I heard it. And remember still, my husband reminds me that I carried this story for about a year. He wasn't sure if I believed it, that my father was in the witness protection program and not really dead. I actually knew that. It helped. And I spent a week at home before my mom said, okay, now it's time for you to go back to school. And so there was never any discussion about whether I would spend some extended amount of time at home or not. Looking back on that, I think that was absolutely the right thing. One, it certainly was a way to most respect the memory of my father, who would have never wanted me not in school for absolutely any reason. And the other piece is having something to do and focus on really helped me to at least move past that time in a way that I don't think I would have been able to do if I had stayed in my small community and just sat there.
Yeah, but it makes sense now. What about at the time? Were you thinking about spending more time? Were you thinking about not going back in your own mind? Mm-hmm. Obviously, everybody else thought you should go back, but
I don't remember a point of being particularly resistant to that, and so I'm not sure that I thought anything. The whole time is one of extreme shock. These were people that we knew, so they were men who had been in our homes who killed my father and later actually killed and tortured an entire family, and so they're both currently on death row in Mississippi. So I think, you know, one of the more difficult things about going back to school is not having the information filtered appropriately. So I remember that I got back to school and I had to go to the academic affairs office and write why I had been away, which made me really angry because I knew that my best friend's aunt had relayed the information. And I remember writing as a way of being a bit defiant in extreme detail what had happened to my father. Not surprisingly, by the time I got back to the dorm room, there were people looking for me.
The impact also on your sense of what that community was. You talked about these being people, the people who killed your father, people you knew, and the close-knit nature of that community that you that you described, a village. I wonder if it changed any of your ideas about that or left you.
They were people who had grown up in the area, left and came back, so I didn't know them when I was growing up. I will say that my father was the kind of person who was quite popular in the area. He was a business owner, and so he knew everyone. Our home was open to people at all times. Any holiday, there were always strangers around the table. And so that felt especially difficult, that he had been such a warm and giving person, and this happened.
You did go back. When did you decide to become a doctor?
After that year of my freshman year of college, I wanted to go home that year because I did feel the need to return home and be with my mother, and I have a younger sister, and they were home, so I wanted to spend the summer home. I arranged to spend the summer working at the Delta Community Health Center there in Mound Bayou. It's actually the oldest rural federally qualified health center in the United States. And as you mentioned in your intro, that's where I became interested in medicine. But I spent the summer there shadowing physicians, helping with administrative tasks, and really decided that this is my way to contribute. I think I've always felt a strong urge to contribute to something. After all, Miss Hawkins in 12th grade said, be ashamed to die unless you've made a worthwhile contribution to society. And so it was, as you said, my plan to return there and help to take care of people who had limited access to health care, primarily African Americans.
Well, let's talk about, again, someone who's driven, who does well in school, who is now on the path to becoming a doctor or has made that decision. What was your social life like in college?
My social life was not that great. I mean, it may surprise you, Frank, to know that I'm not exactly a social butterfly. My daughter will tell you that.
Well,
I'm
no,
quite
your daughter
boring.
Would know that. I wouldn't know that. I don't know why not, except that you're too busy trying to figure out calculus.
Okay. So my college years were spent studying primarily, and you started to mention this, but my husband is my high school sweetheart, and so we met at the age of 8. He reminds me we met on the basketball court. He referred to me as Miss Magic, and he was magic. Later, he would tell me that my basketball skills were not that great, but he let me play on his team because he liked me. And we dated in high school to the extent that my father would allow me to date, which was really limited in his view. You don't need to date until you're 18 or older. But he went to the Air Force, and he was stationed in Fort Walton Beach, Florida, while I was in New Orleans. And so that was a drive. So I spent many weekends with him there in Florida, or he would visit me. And I studied the rest of the time. I didn't join a sorority. I don't remember going to more than one or two college parties.
So I want to probe this a little, this whole basketball thing, because earlier you said he was telling you you had just had a conversation about how competitive you are. And I'm just wondering if he was simply jealous of your basketball skills.
That's
that was
the
probably
way
it,
I
right?
describe it.
You were
it.
Better at, than him. And then he comes up with this other story. So you went to Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, right?
Yes, I did. What a leap.
Yeah, that was it different for you?
Very much so. Even deciding to go to Johns Hopkins, you know, when I think about people in my church and immediate community who were African Americans and who were physicians, certainly not surprising at that time, they had all attended historically black colleges, Howard and Meharry, the kinds of schools who still graduate the majority of African American physicians. And I decided to, and I applied to many of those same institutions. I decided to apply to Johns Hopkins because I was home at Christmas and I was telling my uncle or for some holiday that I was planning to go to medical school. He was very excited about that and he said, "You should go to Johns Hopkins." I just saw a commercial and Johns Hopkins is the number one medical school in the country and that's where you should go. And I thought, okay, so at the very last minute, I applied to Johns Hopkins. In fact, I had already started interviewing for medical school before my Johns Hopkins interview. What I remember before that interview is interviewing at a place in the South. And this was really interesting because I think that even before I entered a majority institution, I had already started on the interview trail, visiting some of those institutions and getting a sense of what that would be like. On one interview, it's structured as a group interview. And so there are three applicants there with a panel full of medical school faculty. And I was in a room where everyone else there was white. There was one applicant, Honey. I still remember her name because one of the medical school faculty kept saying, "Well, Honey, what do you think about this?" And there was a gentleman. And what I remember is being, one, uncomfortable, but two, taken aback by the experience in a way that I felt like, whoa, this is what I'm going to be in for. They asked each of us a question. They asked the gentleman, he had broken a leg, so they asked him how he had gotten hurt and to what extent that had informed his approach to medical school. They asked Honey, when it was time for Honey's question, she was asked, "Who's your favorite singer?" And she said, "Garth Brooks." And Honey and everyone around the table had an extensive conversation about Garth Brooks and the music. The idea was that I would engage in this, except I didn't know any Garth Brooks songs to talk about. And my
that
question,
should be to your credit, if you ask me. I think
that guarantees
your admission to my medical school, but go ahead.
But my question was, I understand that you're from a small town in Mississippi, Mound Bayou, and we know about the federally qualified health center there where you've worked. In fact, I wrote about it in my personal statement for medical school and the importance of underserved communities and reducing disparities. And my question was, if you were the director of Health and Human Services, what solutions or strategies would you propose to reduce disparities in healthcare outcomes for rural communities? And I thought I was prepared to say Michael Jackson. That's not the question I was expecting. And as I sat there, I thought, this is what my dad was talking about. You know, things will be harder for you. And that was before my Johns Hopkins interview, which was a completely different experience. And I immediately loved it. And, you know, my uncle told me I should go to school there and I was accepted. And so I went there. But I do remember at registration being completely overwhelmed. And for the first time since the interview trail, right, I felt like a minority.
Hmm. What did that mean to you going through medical? Medical school is tough enough. So what does it mean to feel like a minority going to a place like Johns Hopkins?
It feels like, one, I need to be twice as good. You know, this message is still there. I still felt like I could achieve anything if I tried. But there is also this burden of feeling like my accomplishments and my failures are not my own. And so that anything I did correctly or not would be seen as a reflection on other African Americans. And I certainly still feel that, but certainly felt an additional burden about whether my actions might reduce opportunities for others. And so I will tell you, medical school is really hard, Frank. And I remember my very first exam. So I've told my husband this. My mom said I never told her this. I made the lowest score in the class of 110 students. I was devastated. I ran back to my dorm room and I called my best friend who now we had parted. So we both finished at Dillard, but she was at Northwestern for graduate school in communications. And she immediately called her aunt, who was a physician in Texas, and put us in touch. And we talked about that experience and how I was still going to get through this. And I won't tell you my score because it's still painful. But clearly I finished medical school.
We're going to take a break. We're going to figure out that score and talk about how that low score didn't mean anything in your career. Dr. Kimberly Johnson, who's a professor in the Division of Geriatrics at Duke University School of Medicine, also a senior fellow at the Center for the Study of Aging and Human Development. And our conversation will continue on the state of things after this. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow, talking to Dr. Kimberly Johnson, who grew up in one of the oldest black communities in the country, planned to become a doctor and move back to her Mississippi hometown, wanted to work at a community health center for the uninsured and underinsured. Then she went to Duke University as an intern and fell in love with academic medicine and changed course. Tell us about coming to Duke.
So this is definitely not what I expected, not just being on the state of things, but also being an associate professor at Duke. After I left Johns Hopkins, I came to Duke for my internship and residency. Really, it was my very top choice, having spent time at Duke on the interview trail and just really loving the environment as well as the camaraderie. And I stayed. I did an internship and a residency. And after that, I spent a year as a chief resident. I was the first African-American chief resident in medicine at Duke. And this is a position that's given to three people current at that time per year at Duke who are graduating residents who demonstrate outstanding clinical and leadership skills. And so I was extremely excited about that, particularly given my start at Johns Hopkins with that low score. Mm-hmm. After that, I stayed on to do geriatric medicine fellowship and joined the faculty. As you said, not exactly part of my plans. I really plan to return to Mississippi and work at the Federally Qualified Health Center, but I really did fall in love with the academic environment. There were so many things going on, so many opportunities for teaching and clinical care. And so to be true to the reason I wanted to become a doctor, my very first clinic was not in our usual geriatrics practice, but I was allowed to arrange a clinic at our residence clinic, which is a clinic in the community that provides care to a population that's largely uninsured and underinsured. So I was the first attending to see patients, have my own patient practice there.
But talk about the academic part. What were you drawn to study? Was it the academic environment or a particular field of study that attracted you?
My interest was really initially in teaching. So I found that I loved education and found that I loved being with residents, interns, and students and teaching them about internal medicine. When I joined the faculty, I was in what we call our clinician educator track. And so I spent a lot of time seeing patients and teaching. About 2 years into my faculty time, I went to my boss then, Harvey Cohen, and said, hey, you know, I love geriatrics, but I really think I want to become a researcher. And he said, a researcher? And I said, yes, I know I've never done research. And he said, you've actually never written an academic paper. And I said, you're absolutely correct, but I've read a lot of papers. And so I'm pretty sure I can do this. And he said, okay. And so as a faculty member, I took coursework in clinical research methods and got a mentor and started doing the work that I do now, which is focused on reducing racial disparities in the quality of end-of-life care for older adults.
Well, how did you get interested in geriatrics in the first place?
The stories. It's like you, Frank, right? I, as a medical student,
men like me attracted you to the whole field.
Not exactly.
How do they do it?
As a medical student, older adults were the population that I was drawn to. I loved the stories of what they remember, not just with respect to there being no penicillin, but their lives. Growing up, I spent a lot of time with my grandparents, maternal and paternal, and so that really spoke to what was important to me. And so I, from the time I was in medical school, decided I was going to be a geriatrician, and that piece didn't change. The focus on end-of-life care was not one that I anticipated. I really initially became interested in geriatrics, focused primarily on helping people to regain their independence. But I took care of a lot of people who were nearing the end of their lives in my practice. The average age of patients was well over 85. And for me, that was extra special. The idea of helping people and their families to transition at one of the most difficult times in their lives really felt like a calling.
Well, tell us more about the disparities you discovered along the way.
So, you know, I like my husband says it's interesting to him that I study end-of-life care. But I think he's right. No matter what I studied, it was likely to be about equity and racial equity in particular, given my upbringing. So from the very beginning, I was interested in learning how to improve the quality of care for older African Americans with serious illness. We know a lot about disparities. I can tell you there is a ton of research documenting disparities in health and health care for African Americans across the entire spectrum. So from prevention all the way through diagnosis and end-of-life care, although the focus on end-of-life care has been considerably less. And so this was the population of patients that I was taking care of. And in particular, I began to learn that those same disparities were present throughout, that African Americans who were nearing the end of their lives were more likely to have problems with communicating with providers. They were less satisfied with the quality of care. They were more likely to experience pain and untreated symptoms. And I wanted to do something about that.
And less likely to take advantage of some of the end-of-life care opportunities. Tell us more about what you found and perhaps why.
Yeah, so, you know, my approach to studying this area has always been about thinking about those types of services and practices that we know are associated with quality and figuring out ways to make sure that African Americans and other minority groups have equal access to those services. And so for me, that started with hospice. We know that hospice is both a philosophy of care and a service that really improves the quality of care for patients who are terminally ill and their families. We also knew and still know from the time that I've studied this that African Americans use these services at significantly lower rates than whites. And so currently about 87% of white patients, 87% of hospice patients are white, about 8% are African American. If we look at the population that I study, older adults with Medicare in particular, we know that about 50% of all older whites will use hospice prior to death, only 38% of African Americans. And so even as hospice has become more widespread and more people are taking advantage of the opportunities, we haven't been able to close that gap.
What do you think is going on there?
There are lots of things going on, as with disparities all the time. The issues are multifactorial. When I initially started, I was interested in understanding patient factors that might explain these differences. And so some of my work, as well as others, discovered that African Americans knew less about hospice. And those who knew more about hospice were actually more likely to use it. No surprise, their knowledge of a service is a prerequisite for its use. We learned that there were issues related to trust. African Americans, for very good reason, based on past injustices and ongoing disparities, trust the health system less. Hospice really focuses on comfort rather than cure. You might imagine that if you're concerned about the quality of care you've received when cure may have been possible, you're less likely to access a service which focuses on comfort only. Another issue has to do with spiritual beliefs. So African Americans endorse greater religiosity than other populations. They're more likely to attend church, have religious affiliations, actually use religion as a way to make decisions. And so some of the spiritual beliefs that we found were important were African Americans believe that only God determines life and death, that death, like other obstacles, is a test of faith, and admitting that you're approaching the end of life may mean that you don't have enough faith. Some of the things that we looked at beyond that, as I would like to say my research matured, I really began to think about, beyond patients, how systems and organizations can address the things that keep people from accessing services that we know improve quality. And so I've looked at hospice organizations to understand what are their practices that actually increase service use for African Americans, and trying to identify what are the best practices that might be portable. So some of the things that we've learned is that there's a focus on increasing the number of African American staff, certainly by having people who look like you. It's a way to build trust and community in a service. Reaching out to organizations of importance in the African American community. The church, for instance, has long been a way for African Americans to receive information and services related to health care. So those are kind of two of the more common things that hospice organizations have done. And really also addressing things that are non-medical. When patients are near the end of their lives, and families in particular, those who have lower means, those things that were present before just become magnified. So the absence of adequate food and shelter, and the kinds of things that make the end of life really more pleasant and increase quality beyond what we do medically.
And advanced care planning is something that also plays a part in this. And of course, it really takes place on the legal side before you reach crisis, right? I mean, it becomes something you talk to a lawyer about, not a doctor. And I wonder if there's a disparity there in terms of the level at which people do advanced care planning, and what would be done to address that.
Yeah, so that's the other piece. And for me, it's still thinking about what are the things that increase quality. So hospice is clearly one of those things. The other thing that I'm currently studying in a large multi-site study that's funded by the Patient-Centered Outcomes Research Institute is advanced care planning. And advanced care planning means thinking about, talking about, and writing down your wishes for future medical care. So the majority of people will die not being able to tell us what they want. And advanced care planning allows you to make those wishes known and to select someone who would make medical decisions for you if you're unable to make them for yourself. An important point is that you don't have to go to a lawyer to participate in advanced care planning. You can do that via documents that are widely available. They are state legal documents. We also encourage people to look beyond the documents and have the conversations. African Americans are less likely to want to sign formal documents. Many of these documents focus on the kind of care that people would not want. And we know African Americans are more likely to want the life-prolonging therapies, even when prognosis is poor, and so may not feel that those kinds of documents are applicable. For our work, we've actually looked at African Americans and the extent to which they do advanced care planning, and there's a large body of research that documents they do this less often. So in a recent study, only 20% of African Americans had discussed and written down their wishes, compared to over two-thirds of whites. Similarly, only a third had named someone to make decisions for them, where you see three-fourths of whites doing that. And the reason this is important is that when we know that when people talk about their wishes for medical care, guess what? They're more likely to receive the care that they would want. They have better communication with providers. And importantly, their families are less burdened by decision-making. And so there's evidence that family members have less stress and anxiety after their loved ones are gone. all areas, and they're more likely to use hospice, all areas that we know African Americans receive lower quality, and advanced care planning could improve that.
In October, you won a grant to lead the Duke Center for Research to Advance Healthcare Equity. It's known as REACH Equity for short. Talk about REACH Equity and what you're doing, what kind of work you're doing.
REACH Equity is an extremely exciting project for us. So this is one of 12 Centers of Excellence in Health Disparities Research funded by the NIH. It's the first time Duke has had a Center of Excellence, and we have an incredible team of health disparities researchers. There are a couple of things about REACH Equity that I think are important. The first is, while we know that there is a large body of research documenting disparities, I call them head-to-toe disparities, there's no organ system virtually that you can name, or disease state, or even age group where African Americans are not disadvantaged with health. What we haven't done very well is identify solutions. And so, number one, REACH Equity focuses on developing and testing interventions to actually reduce racial and ethnic disparities in health. The second part is the focus on health care or the clinical encounter. There's lots of research that has focused on access, whether people can even get to the doctors or access care. But there's a nice Institute of Medicine report written in the early 2000s that says, even when blacks and whites have similar access to health care, income, and insurance, African Americans are still at higher risk of receiving lower quality care across diseases. And so we really are focused on the clinical encounter. What can providers and health systems do when patients enter the clinical encounter that reduces disparities and improves health?
Well, I wonder, you talked about loving storytelling, listening to stories. That's what got you involved in geriatrics. And I wonder, as a physician, how important that is for you in terms of diagnostics, improving that clinical experience. And the reason I ask about asking for stories and listening to stories is, you know, how important is it to have somebody on the clinician, the practitioner, understand your story, having lived it? In other words, look like you, or at least have shared your experience to hear your story.
That is, you know, that's the crux. You know, we know that the clinical experience impacts health and health outcomes. And we also know that many aspects of that experience are of lower quality for African Americans. Our center actually specifically looks at some of those aspects. So one of our interventions is based on communication. Lots of research showing that African Americans experience lower quality communication and have poor physician relationships. One focuses on developing and testing an implicit bias training intervention. We know that patients, African Americans and minority patients, are more likely to face unconscious bias, meaning physicians are more likely to have unconscious negative attitudes towards them that might impact their care. And so I think understanding how we can improve care between patients and doctors and health systems is really important in our approach to reducing disparities.
So Duke did well naming you chief resident way back when. Mm-hmm. And I know it's a kind of a bittersweet honor for you to be considered the first African-American in that position, because you were named to that position, first African-American, but that was in the 1990s, which came late as far as you're mm-hmm. concerned. Tell us more about that. And I guess this is my last question to you. Are things changing? Are things getting better now?
Yeah, are things getting better, and how do I reflect on all of those experiences? I think there are many things that are better that we can be proud of. And so I was the first African-American chief resident at Duke. There have been a number of them since. You know, what's not getting better is that still only 4% of all graduates from medical school are African American. One of the real opportunities for us has been how we increase that pipeline, particularly people who are involved in health disparities research, and that's actually part of the work of our center. The other piece of, you know, are we getting better? Are we getting better at reducing gaps in quality between African Americans and whites? And I think, while there are some things that are better, more African Americans are using hospice, the problem is that the equity gap still continues. One of the stories that
Dr. Johnson, I'm going to have to save that story for the next time you're on.
Okay.
And I know that's going to happen, because we're going to talk more about your research. But what a delight to meet you in this hour today.
Well, thank you for having me.
Dr. Kimberly Johnson is an associate professor of medicine in the Division of Geriatrics at Duke University School of Medicine, You can find out more about her work at our website, stateofthings.org. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.